But the other reason, and the chief reason, and the point that I'll probably dwell on the longest this morning, is this, the subject of the art of listening, or our failure to listen. As I said the other night, and many of you were present, that we have this problem. In our family, we don't listen to our wives, we don't listen to our children, they don't listen to us. And the people that we love, we would die for, we don't listen to them. And this is a very serious problem. And it's one reason we're often in trouble. Probably it's one of the reasons that businesses fail. And we'll get into this later on in the discussion. And I mentioned God had the same trouble. The prophet, you have ears, but you do not hear. You know? And 1,200 times in the Bible, they're talking about hearing and listening. And they had the same problem. Now, to spend a little bit of time on noise and sound, and some of the research that has gone on in this subject is very interesting. Perhaps just to remind you that sound travels about 1,100 feet per second in air, 5 times as fast in water, and 15 times in solid. And you could, like 50 pounds of dynamite, if you blow it, you can hear it probably 10 miles. But if in water, you could probably hear it for 10,000 miles. This is kind of an interesting thing that a lot of people don't realize. I usually go into frequency and intensity to explain that. We're running a little behind time. I have a little note down here, you know, you have to give a few cultural points along the way or just little points that you have to, that's handy to remember. The softest sound that we can hear is a baby mouse urinating on a dry blotter 3 feet away. we have now devices in our technology today. We have devices that are most unusual for recording sound, and we have devices, for example, that can record the sound of a piece of Kleenex hitting the pavement 50 feet away, or there are devices so that on a quiet night you can have this device on floor level on the side of the building, and you can record what is being said on the 10th floor. And these are the kind of instruments that we have available to us. Now, what are some of the effects of sound? And for a long time, there was very little research on sound. I mean, the people that were working on sound, I mean, they were kind of labeled as nuts. You know? I mean, so what are these guys up to? But there's been a rather recent impetus given to this, and of course there's many things. The reason for a lot of impetus given to something is that it might be utilizable either to control people or to destroy them or to compromise them or their equipment. And there's a good deal of secret research underway now. And to give you some example of this, they have built, for example, unusual devices that have, like, sirens with 175 decibels, which is about 10,000 times the sound of a riveting gun. If you've ever been near a riveter, you probably didn't stay there very long, but this is about 10,000 times that. And strange things happen when you get into the field. For example, if you stick your hand in there, it'll burn it. And he put the marbles, 3-4-inch marbles over it, and they just sort of rested in the air. I mean, they just were suspended in the air. It caused a piece of cotton wad to burn, to burst into flame. Then he put a pipe in it and lit the pipe. It's an expensive way to light your pipe, though, so I don't recommend that. It killed a mouse in it within 1 minute, just putting in it by overheating. And it disintegrated insects in 10 seconds. Now, it's because of things like this that they said, boy, this must be utilizable probably in war or in some of our sensitive equipment. You can compromise electronic equipment this way. And another facet of it, too, is I mentioned the controlling people. Yeah, as a possibility of breaking up mobs. In some riots, the mob, this technique has been utilized. They'll go in there with all their sirens going, and you lose your trend of thought this way. If you have enough of them going, you can essentially compromise a mob. And also, you have this thing of resonance. You know, if you go to a piano and you sort of hit the A on it, for example, and you have a banjo right near it, the banjo will start resonating, you see. And a university professor at Columbia utilized this as a test method for some students. He brought the students in, and then using about some sound, about 75 cycles per second, which is about next to lowest B on the piano. And it was just took a few seconds for a lot of people to leave the room, because at 75 cycles per second, this is near the resonance frequency of the anal sphincter. And when you got playing it, boy, people start to go out their room. And you can see the power of this device, and this is why there's a lot of investigation, boy. This is how you could compromise rioters. I don't know, but maybe there's a lot of work on this. It's probably going down at Berkeley right now. It's south of where I live. And also, it can also be used for you men to attract women. At the Newport Jazz Festival, somebody observed it was a girl lying with her ear down on the floor near the bass fiddler. And she said, and they asked her, "What the world are you doing that for?" And she said, "Boy, that sound coming through the floor next to the bass fiddler really turns me on." And she said she really got a real unusual sensation out of it. Well, she really must have, because in about a year she married him. But sounds do really turn people on. Another utilization of it is to drown out pain. And in fact, audio analgesia is being utilized, for example, in dentistry in some places today. Some people, if you have what we call white sound, or maybe Beethoven, if you play it and you sort of overwhelm the person, and you could probably pull out a whole mouthful of teeth, and they didn't really bother them too much. Maybe it gets to them later, but at least during the time, it has worked. It doesn't work on all people, of course, but it has worked on some, and there's a good deal of investigation along this line, and I think it would be a far more pleasant way. And I know there's a couple of dentists here, and maybe they'll have something to say about it. Noises can also drive people crazy. Now, I talked about the deteriorating quality of our environment the other day, and I didn't mention intentionally, this fact of the deteriorating quality of our environment due to increase in sound. For the past 30 years, they have estimated that there's been about a 1 decibel increase in our sound level in the United States, 1 decibel per year. Well, this is very disturbing, of course, and it's going to have an effect on the efficiency of people. If you're interrupted, for example, in sleep, some people are tough enough to live with it as it is, you know, and if you interrupt their sleep, it's even worse. I think our voice, the normal speaking voice, mine's a little higher, but I suppose it's about 60 decibels. Well, they've run studies, for example, in New York, and when you get up around 70 decibels or so, and there's a lot of the time that you're 70 to 75 decibels, you have to really shout to be heard. You know? This kind of thing really bothers people. And if you interrupt your sleep, for example, you know this dream thing. You I don't know if you know it or not, but at least the psychologists tell me you have to dream a certain amount. You know, and if you're and you can tell when a person is dreaming by EEGs and watching his eye or her eyes. And if you continually interrupt at the time of the dreams, you can essentially drive a person crazy. Well, if you have a lot of noise and you're disrupting it, you're going to have even more crazier people than we have now. Now, there was an interesting study on some rats, and they thought maybe rats were getting altruistic, you know. They ran this experiment where they'd hang a rat up, and when he was hanging by, I think, his foot, you know, he screamed bloody murder. And they trained these rats then that they could eliminate this noise by pressing a lever, would release the rat, and he'd lay down. I mean, he would hit the deck again, and of course quit screaming. And they said, "Look at this, boy, these rats are great. They have concern for their brother." And then somebody, this has always happened in science, you know, you have a beautiful theory, then some ugly fact disrupts it. But these fellows decided that they did not only do this experiment, but they put in an alternate lever, which would turn on immediately white sound, which would essentially wipe out the sound of the rat screaming that was hanging by his leg. And then the rats, instead of releasing their brother, they turned on the white sound so that it couldn't be heard. Maybe this says something to us. Now, let's talk a little bit about the art of listening. Part of this material that I'm going to give you is from Nichols at Minnesota. And in fact, I gave this talk sort of modification of this to our class in a professional school in physiology. It was the first lecture in the course. And one of the first things I asked him was, have any of you had a course in learning, listening comprehension, or the art of listening? And there wasn't anybody who answered to the affirmative. Perhaps I should ask this today, but we won't take time for it. But some of you, if you have, I'd like to talk to you afterwards. Last year, there was one person who had had a course in it. In fact, businesses are now giving this course for the benefit of their employees. Rankin in Ohio did a study, and we do this in industry. I spent a good deal of time in industry at a large corporation, a large company, General Electric Company, and we did time studies there, part of it for efficiency, but just to see how we were wasting our time, or how we were utilizing it, how one could become more efficient. Well, Rankin at Ohio did a rather intensive study of 60 people. And he wanted to find out just how they spent their day. Before I say this, I should mention that about 98% of what we learn through our eyes and ears. Now, he noticed that in this group of people, that 70% of the day, of their day, was spent in communication. 9% was spent in writing, 16% in reading, 30% in speaking, 45% in listening. Now, this may not be true in all households. It's quite a bit different in some households. Now, what kind of time do we spend in school on this? And part of this is to help you students out, as I hope I helped some of our students at the University of California. Now we spend, I imagine, some of us spend 16 years, you know, trying to learn how to write. And many of us don't learn how to write in that time. Yet we only do this 9% of our time, as an average. We spend at least probably, I don't know, 8 or 12 years learning how to read, yet we do not spend a great deal of time compared with other things, like speaking and listening. 30%, in speaking, we're doing that more now. I think I had a course in public speaking once, and some of you probably questioned it, but I did have. My lecture colleague, I remember in high school, I mean, who took speaking? Huh? It was the lawyer's son or the preacher's son, maybe. I mean, they were on the debate team. Most other people didn't bother to learn how to speak or try to learn how to speak. But in listening, nah. Now, there was a survey done by Nichols in the early 50s. And he said, who is teaching listening, and listening comprehension? One place was teaching at the college level. It was Stevens College for Women. They were teaching the girls how to listen. They were very successful. I know some of them, and they picked good husbands. And they knew how to listen, I guess. It was taught as one of the social graces. And in the early 50s, Nichols made a survey of all the papers in the literature for a certain period of time, in the technical literature. What are these subjects discussing? And for 3,000 papers on communication, I think there was probably 2,999 on various forms of communication other than listening. There was one on listening comprehension. This was the extent of the thing in the 1950s. Now, some university experience at Columbia, Harvey Jones had a class of 486 freshmen in psychology. And he was doing some testing on them to determine to what extent they were comprehending what was being told them. Because I feel that the lecture system is not a good way of learning. It's one person said it went out with a printing press. But it is one way of trying to instruct, but not probably a very effective one. And this is the conclusion Harvey Jones came to. Now, what he did, because he'd give a test, you see, I mean, he'd give a what he called an inspiring lecture. He'd give a test, and it's very disturbing to give a test to somebody you've spoken to and find out how little they can tell you about what you told them. It's a very disheartening thing. It was a disheartening thing to Dr. Jones. So what he said, maybe it's the quality of the lecture. That so what I'll do, I'll get some inspired lectures in here. I'll get the best lectures I can find. They'll get 10 minutes on their favorite subject. So boy, these fellows are really hepped up. This is what he did. And he gave some tests. And he found out that after these inspiring lectures, the people themselves would give the test. Maybe part of the problem was the method of testing. But they only immediate retention was only about 50% of what he told them. He waited a couple of months, and then it was down to 25%. Well, if you only comprehend about one quarter of what you hear, you can extend this to many situations. Although, if they've ever been a father of teenagers, they'd be very happy to have 25% retention, even after 10 minutes. But this was a sad state of affairs. And well, Nichols was sort of disturbed about this too, so he ran his own experiment. You like to check on some of these professors. And this is what he did. He essentially gave the same thing. Only he didn't wait 2 months for the second test. He gave it just in a couple of weeks. And he said, if I waited a couple of days, I'd have got about the same results. And he had about the same results as Rankin. After a couple of days, it was about 25%. And you're talking now about people who are rather bright students. I mean, I don't know if I can make Columbia right now, you know. I mean, they have quite selective in their student body. So these aren't really dumb kids. They're very bright kids. So Nichols decided that, well, let's really examine this to see what makes a good listener and what makes a bad listener. And after he had run a number of studies on these, and he sort of divide them up as to who wasn't learning and who was learning and their ability to really comprehend. He ran a lot of studies on them, and he found out some characteristics of bad listeners, and that's what I'm going to give you now, probably 8 or 9 characteristics of a bad listener, and hope that it will help you to listen better. Now, the first characteristic of a bad listener was that as soon as the subject was mentioned, you know, oh boy, what I need that for, you know. Immediately you turn a guy off because this is an uninteresting subject to you. What can I use that for, you know? And I heard college students ask college students, but, well, I tell my students, you know, that you can ask questions of me anytime during my lecture, and I can say that to you now. But I'll tell you as I tell them, I'm not young enough to have all the answers. But, you don't always know what really is going to be helpful to you, huh? You don't know the future. And one of my favorite characters, writer, is G.K. Chesterton. I like him because he had some kind things to say about pigs and a lot of other things. But he was a very astute fellow. And he said that there was no such a thing as an uninteresting subject, just uninterested listeners. So what you have to do is look at a subject and say, well, all right, so maybe I can't see any use for this, but let's examine. Let's hear him out and see what he has to say. Maybe there's something in it. And I hope you, so noise is no interest to you, or maybe you're not interested in listening, but just hear it out. See if there might be something and accept it as a challenge. Now, the other thing is, the second point is, they criticize the speaker, or they overreact to him. And I'll tell you in a minute what I did to the class. But today, some of you are looking at me now. I know you are. You're saying, boy, I'd like to have that nose full of nickels. Those ears on that guy, I thought Clark Gable was dead. You know, Clark Gable, some of you, was an actor many years ago. He had very good ears. Or some of you are looking at my feet and you're saying, the socks don't even match. No, some of you have already seen that. Okay? And instead of listening to me, you say to yourself, get a load of that guy. Typical professor. You can't even match his socks. Or they look at the sweatshirt and say, boy, they don't sell that kind anymore. And they look at that 1962. That's what I did. I got
a
1962.
You know what I asked him? What wonderful help you were in the kitchen several years ago.
You see, but this is what happens, you know. On my class, I walked in and I used to have a lab coat on, but under my lab coat, in this class, I wore what my son calls a belly warmer top. Remember a few years ago, we wore belly warmers. They're coming back now. They're about this wide down there. A great tie, you know, a great tie right there. I saved some of these. I pulled it up. I put it on, you know. And a lot of students came up to me afterwards and said, boy, we wondered about that tie. But you see, while they were wondering about that tie, when you were looking at my socks, you were missing probably several jewels of wisdom. You know? What I'm saying, it's just like when you read the book, and Hard Hong taught me this, you know, I become so concerned with the author all the time. What about the author? And Hard Hong said, forget about the author. Look at the book. What does it say? Well, that's how you should react to a speaker. What is he saying? You know, not what does he look like? Boy, I'm late before I start. So don't overreact to the speaker, or worry about my English isn't too good. But if I came in here, or somebody came in here and said, "Hey, bug out of this rat nest," the place is burning up. You know, you don't stop and say, "For yesterday, couch that in better rhetoric." Another thing that students don't, they become over-concerned with the facts. You know, you're listening now, what did he tell us? He told us about that little mouse. What was it, 3 feet away? Become over-concerned with facts. And you remember, instead of looking at the main idea that the person is trying to get at, they're looking at the facts, 1492 or 1700 when the British discovered America. You try to remember these, and you get down. One of the things I really tee off on in medical literature, especially, is 92.3% showed this. 92.35%. There's nothing that you in biology that's a biological significance beyond two significant figures. Not even a woman's age, and that's the most significant biological phenomenon. It is not significant beyond two significant figures. I don't care whether you're 29 or 29.2. And yet we do that, and you try to, you know, you say, well, 19.3. Maybe it's 8 cases out of 11, you know. But they take it to 4. Become over-concerned with facts. You've got to get the main idea. What are we trying to get across? Another thing that students do, they become overzealous on an outline. I remember students when I was at the University of Washington, and I make a fairly good outline myself. I fell in this trap. Boy, I had some neat notes, boy. Really neat notes. I haven't looked at them since. You know? I had neat notes, you know, worried about them. And I remember one fellow, he's from Harvard, and he's come there to medical school. And boy, I mean, I think he was measuring down, you know, he had a real neat outline. But he didn't get any in the course. Well, I mean, he was so worried about that outline, and he was missing a lot of points that they were trying to get at. Another thing is taking attention, you know. Instead of just sitting back and say, what is this guy saying? I want to show him that, especially students in the front row. Well, I like to sit in the front row myself, part of it because I don't hear too well in spite of my ears, but relax rather than, you know, make the professor think that you're really listening when you're really not. Another thing that you do, a lot of people do, is tolerate a bad performance. I get so mad, and I told the students this. I sit up in back of the room and teach them. In our professional course, where we have multiple instructors, I try to make every lecture, even though I'm not getting the lectures each time. In fact, I don't give very many lectures. But I sit up in the back of the room. It's a very large lecture room. And these students, the best is that some of them, I mean, they act like they just don't give a damn, you know? I mean, to what is the common vernacular? Some of the professors, they put charts up there, and I don't think they can even see him in the first row, you know, let alone back where I am. And I can't see anything up here without glasses, but boy, I can see back there, you know. And I can't see some of the things. They have figures up there, you can't tell what they are. Students, they don't say anything. Some of it's off the screen, the professor's shoving them in here, the projector's back there, you know. Or they can't hear them. Did they say anything? Yeah, they let them go on, you know. And I tell them, boy, if you can't hear, if you want to hear, you better do something about it. That's of course, they're doing something about it now. But they don't, you know, they don't go and tell the professor. They sort of start a big sit-in or something like this. Maybe that's one way of getting at it. Some of the revolt on the campus today is a revolt against bad teaching. And boy, it's about time. Huh? It's about time. Another thing, and to really become a good listener, you've got to practice good listening, you know? I mean, and what Nichols did, he surveyed some of these people, the bad listeners, and he asked them, what programs do you watch on TV, you know? Red Skelton. I don't know of any TV programs. And probably I'll mention some of these. You know, some of these simple ones. I guess that's most of them, isn't it? Mother's Brothers and stuff like that. Where some of that require very high technical listening, you know, they turn them off. They never listen to these. They said, boy, I can't even understand what they're talking about, rather than saying, boy, maybe I can get something out of this. Maybe I can learn how to learn something by listening to these, you see? Another thing, you let emotional words throw up, you know? I probably said some words here that shook you up, you know. Like if I started to say, you know, 1492, you know, well, all you Norwegians said, he's going to tell us that Columbus discovered America in 1492. You know good and well Columbus didn't discover America because you know Leif Erikson did. So you're aroused. And you're aroused and then you don't hear what I say. Or other words, Harry Truman. Sex. Some of you are aroused by that. or Freud now. Freud this week. Or LSD. Later on I'll be talking about this. But boy, you mentioned LSD and some of you immediately, I mean, you start thinking, you know, and I've turned you off. Or Stokely Carmichael, Rat Brown, De Gaulle. I mean, a lot of these kind of words, you let them throw you. Another thing is we have mental lapses, and I intentionally talk rather rapidly here today. I didn't talk as rapidly as I thought I would. I meant to. The people that are sitting here listening to me today, you have the ability to probably listen and comprehend if I spoke at probably 300 words per minute instead of ordinary conversation. We usually lecture at about this speed, which is probably about 100 words per minute. When in reality, I have, through the years, with this kind of a presentation, I always bring work with me. For example, I go to a lot of seminars because many of my students and others or visiting people, they come and they give seminars at about this speed, you see, and they discuss various subjects. I always bring a lot of work with me. And I write several letters or make some notes for the next lecture while these people are giving their seminar. And still I don't miss too much of the seminar. Because I fixed it, I turn them off, and that's what you do. I mean, you turn the speaker off, you turn him off for about 30, 40 seconds, then you turn him on for about 10 seconds when he's speaking like this. Where if he was speaking very rapidly, boy, you try to keep up with him, you try to listen to everything he said, you see? And I think with time, and I tried this out in my class, because I put out lecture notes so that Maybe they don't have to be secretary too much, or they don't have to be auditor to get it, because they have all the figures before them. But then I can speak faster, I can get to the subject matter at hand, and also you'll find that the people pay close attention when you're speaking very rapidly. So that's hopefully what will happen. Now, with time, as we advance in this area. Now, what did the good listeners do? This is just some, hopefully, some helpful hints. The good listener did three things. He anticipated the next point. With some lectures, this is rather difficult. So you're really learning that by contrast, you know. What is he going to say next? So you sort of make a guess, maybe, on what he's going to say next. And then if it's wrong, then you can say, well, you're sort of repeating, and you say, you're comparing, and with contrast, and you say, maybe this will help you retain it. Another thing you try to do is identify building blocks in his structure, if he's presenting a certain subject. If Paul is talking about economics, you're trying to, you not only anticipate the next point, you also say, what is he going to build on today? And I tried that on him today. I was seeing on how are you going to build the structure of it. And so you're really learning while he's talking, and you're trying to anticipate it. And then not only the next point, but you're developing a structure. And then you pick out the evidence that he's trying to present, or your argument against him. And then the other thing is you do mental recapitulation, especially if they're not speaking very rapidly. You go back and say, well, what has he said now? You should be going back and saying, well, what are these traits of bad measure? What should I be doing? I shouldn't, you know, and you go back and you recapitulate. What are these points he's making? See? And this will help you retain it. Now, I wanted to finish a little ahead of time for a couple of reasons. And I'd already talked to Ken a little bit. We discussed some of this last night. As to what extent are we teaching the art of listening now? I know that some industries are, and I was supposed to get a course that was being offered by Minneapolis Honeywell. Fellow that was here last year is going to send it to me. He hasn't sent it to me yet, but maybe he'll still get it to me out while I'm here during the next 2 weeks. But I want to ask Ken to what extent. First, I want to ask, have any of you had a course in listening, art of listening, or the listening comprehension? Has anybody had it here?
You mean speed reading?
No, not speed reading, just learning how to listen and comprehend. I mean, directly as a course. Some of you have, yes. There's a few that have. To what extent is this in the school system, like, say, in Oregon, Ken?
As far as I know, there's nothing formalized in this line. Individual teachers may do something, but much of what they do with individual teachers may be negative. I've seen experiments with where we televise the teacher and the class at the same time. The teacher can watch these two at the same time on screens later, and one of their first comments often is, do I talk that much? And we tend to confuse talking or teaching with the students learning. And really, what we're doing many times is getting in the way of their learning. And I think by talking too much, we are negatively conditioning them to turn it off. So I say, probably we're teaching, but we're teaching the wrong way. Conditioning the wrong way.
Yes.
Might it be useful to some of the learning listeners to receive some comments from you pertaining to their attention?
Well, the question is on comments relative to attention spans, and of course people vary in this, and a pastor told me once that I was supposed to give a sermon in a church, and he said, remember that everything beyond 20 minutes is of the devil. Well, I guess it's a lot depends on the subject matter, and I think attention spans vary a great deal. And people themselves vary a great deal in attention span. It's kind of hard to be didactic on that or to make any flat statement. Does anybody want to comment on this?
I know one way of getting a little longer. I tell them that they can listen 1 minute per IQ. You know, beyond, I mean, 13 minutes is 100 IQ. Every minute they can last beyond that, you know, that. And then you get a hold of them a little bit longer.
Yes.
Could you comment on the individual's ability of listening to a lecture and thinking it all stuff? Crystallize the speaker's main points. I've looked at other students' notes when I was a student, and I find quite a variation in what the individual crystallizes out.
Some of them deal in details. One of our great problems, you know, is separating the significant from the inconsequential. This is a very disturbing, I mean, it's a very difficult thing. And we have to learn to pick out the real content. You've probably heard this story about, probably a tired old story. This kid was working at a grocery store. And his job was to, they had a whole pile of spuds there, you know, separate the big ones. The small one. Put the big one over here, small one over here. Near the end of the day, the boss came around and said, how are things going? And he said, well, your pay is very good here. And the people that work here are very fine. I mean, I really enjoy them. They're being kind to me. But he says, I'm quitting. Why are you quitting? He says, the decisions are killing me. Separating the significant from the inconsequential. And this is a problem. I mean, What are the significant points in a lecture? And I think this probably takes training. What are these concepts? Rather, and I try to hit that a little bit, that the facts themselves, the three significant figures, are not important, but the round numbers may be.
Leo, what you're talking about here is what education, historically speaking, has always done until we got to modern education. I mean, rhetoric. Trivium, you know, the quadrivium, the you had to have rhetoric before you get any further. You wouldn't get into the last four before you got through the first three. And I have never had a confirmation class where I don't spend a great deal of time with them on just listening. Because they got to listen to my sermons for one thing, and that takes something. So I always tell them that you can always get it in three sentences. What, how, or why, and so what. And if they give me more than three sentences, I won't give them credit for it, because I don't have time to read that many anyway. And we just drilled them. I said, now, if you get this year, I'm going to have two-thirds of you in the Honor Society in high school. And I expect that two-thirds of you should be on the Honor Society in high school. Because if you've learned to listen, if the teacher's prepared it, if he hasn't prepared it, of course, you can't get it. But that's Aristotle. Unity, coherence, emphasis. Unity, coherence, emphasis. It hasn't been improved on since. Because that's what communication is. Unity, coherence, emphasis. And if it doesn't have that, it isn't communication. It's somebody spouting off in a classroom or something. But if they learn to listen like that, they can put it into three sentences. And then I come and get in the column the same way. You don't have to take a whole page full of notes, put down three sentences, and then put over on the right-hand side some facts you want to remember you might forget.
That's a very good point. I often, it's a good idea. I think I don't think pastors mind it. And I often take notes on sermons to see, well, I check to see if he really made an outline himself. what are the points you're trying to make? But also, what did he get across? I mean, I made a few mental notes, for example, a Bible study in Cheryl this morning. I mean, he made a couple of points that really hit me. And I write those down. I carry a little note called Hold on It. I keep track of some of these things. In the blue.
Go ahead, but. Oh, I was going to say, as far as education, formalized education is concerned, don't you think that we have been greatly conditioned by our ineffectiveness in the testing measurement area? In other words, many of us assume that these kids must know every tiny minute detail of our pearls of wisdom, and as such, we condition them not to listen, but to reiterate what we have just said.
That's exactly.
This is not enough ground.
Yeah. The point that's being made has to do with our testing and measurement, which is a very difficult area in which so many people teaching today have never had any training in how to test, how to measure. Of course, it's a difficult area. I discussed this with Paul last night because it's very disturbing to me because I have not been a full-time academician until 2.5 years ago. And I went around listening to professors. I looked at some of their how they question, how they test, and it's very disturbing to me that we haven't made any more progress than we have. And some of these people, some of the testing they do, I mean, this is how you condition them, you know? I mean, you sort of make out the questions as to how they'll be easiest to grade, you know? And this is a lousy way to do it, you know. But how do you make it? This is a very difficult thing. As I told Paul last night, how do you test whether the curriculum in the medical school, for example, is right? Many curriculums today in medical schools are being radically changed, very radically changed, and because they don't think, well, what they've been doing is right. And that may be true to an extent, but I don't know if we have a real good method of testing it. Now, part of what our we professors are graded to an extent at the University of California. I mean, the students give an evaluation at the end of it. Now, some of these are pretty lousy. We have a multiple course, and one of the comments one of the students made online, at least he was funny, you know? Well, boy, that's a kind of a lousy statement. It didn't really help, you know? What you really need is constructive criticism. Some of them do give it. And some of them, of course, a baloney artist or a real ham might get a pretty high rating. But the subject matter he gave might be real lousy, you know, and it was kind of it sort of tickled the ears at the time, you know, but it didn't wear well, you know, and I'm sure that a lot of people, like even in physiology, which I helped instruct, which is given in the first year, if we retested these at the end of 4 years, we'd be exceedingly disturbed. You know? It's just like Paul maybe he could tell it. Of course, in economics, principles of economics, given at early times to a class, sophomore, and then they tested them.
They tested seniors, yeah. And they divided those who had principles of economics sophomores and those who had not, and found that the seniors who had not had the course knew more. They did better on the test. It wasn't significantly better, but in fact, no difference.
You see, this is a frightening thing. Pardon?
Could this not be due to conceptual learning as opposed to factual learning?
Yeah, that's exactly
then
right.
We should have our tools, the factual, and forget about the conceptual.
There was an interesting study done on medical students. Only they took they tested these people, or they tried to evaluate. Of course, how do you evaluate? But they evaluated the physician many years out, and they felt that the physicians were doing the best job. Had been in a problem-solving situation in their instruction. So they got the concepts, and they were in a problem-solving situation. I mean, I think if the students had to get up and give part of the lecture with small groups, they'd learn a lot more. I mean, like who learned the most about listening today? It's the fellow that.